This is an interview with Maurizio Paraguez. It's taking place in Town Hall House in Sydney. The project is the Homeless Persons Information Centre, known as HPIC, Oral History Project. It's being conducted on behalf of the City of Sydney's History Program. I'm Margot Beasley, and the date is the 4th of June 2009. So, Maurizio, or Morris, as most people call you,
yes.
Would you mind telling me where and when you were born?
I was born at Sydney Women's Hospital.
Right. Now, we're talking to you today because you're the coordinator of HPIC services here in the City of Sydney. But you haven't always been in that position, and you connected with homeless people quite a long time before you even came to work here, I think. So could you tell me a bit about that? Although you were born in Australia, your family comes from Chile, I think, is that correct?
Yes, my family, they're from Chile in South America. Both my parents arrived in Australia at a very young age. Dad being 21, I believe, and mum 19. And with my brother, who was a year old at the time. So, as part of the City of Sydney, I have been the coordinator for the past, I think, 4 years now. And I've been with the city for close to a bit over 11 years, I believe. Prior to that, I was overseas for 6 years, and during that time, I also volunteered at Men's Catholic Refuge for a number of years as a volunteer.
Mm. So, what I think you went overseas. You went to travel and went to Chile, you know, for obvious reasons. That's where your family's roots were, and so on. But what attracted you to volunteering at the refuge, the Men's Refuge? Chile. Where was that? Which city was that in?
In Santiago.
Mm.
I've always, for a number of years, I've always either assisted or sponsored people from overseas. I had a sponsorship with World Vision. And that went on for, I think, close to 12 years, that sponsorship. Shumuli Sandari from India, and when that finished, that was actually close to the time that finished when I went overseas, and my trip overseas was a bit after a number of years after high school. My plans for high school were to enter cadetship through the Royal Australian Navy to become an officer. I need to get my facts and figures wrong, because I applied for the cadetship whilst in Year 12, when I should have applied at a Year 11 and entered the cadetship whilst in Year 12. I did all my physical, my exams and so forth, but I did get asked twice how old you were, and then final interview, I remember going to the Parramatta office with my mum. I got a nice little letter from the sort of criteria saying that you must be under 18, and by the time I would have finished the first series of examination, I would have been 18. That they did offer me a placement in the Royal Australian Navy, but actually my intentions were always to go in as a cadet and come out as an officer, and to work in the fields of electronics in helicopters. That I didn't apply for the universities back then, because I was, had in my mind, I was certain I was going to join the Navy.
So I think you did a skilled, you trained as a skilled tradesman, didn't you?
I continued as a skilled tradesman after that. I bummed around at home for a few weeks. My dad came up to me and said to me, you can leave my house and work, or you can go away and join the dog here, but I won't have you here doing nothing. So he took me to his work, which in turn I registered for TAFE, and I did a few trades in drafting and boiler making and welding and cranes, and became a fitter at the same location that my dad was working. And I was there for a number of years in the maintenance department. So.
And then you decided to go off travelling, did you?
My travel plans were only for a 2 or 3 week stint, I think it was, back then, overseas. I really wanted to see my brother. He was overseas.
In Chile?
He was in Chile at the time because he was working for cruise liners. So he was travelling all over the world in the cruise liners, and he was based in Chile, where he was going to be there for the... I'm not sure whether it was a winter or summer period, I don't recall. But I went over there, and I also wanted to see my grandma. And went for 3 weeks. I'm sure it was 3 weeks. Phoned back, said if I can have another extension for 2 more weeks. Said yes. Phoned back after 2 weeks and decided not to come back. And I stayed overseas close to a bit over 6 years.
And that was pretty much all in Chile, was it?
Pretty much all in Chile. Travelled heaps to Chile, Argentina, Peru, Bolivia, did the Inca Trail.
And in Chile, you worked, I think. Did you have paid employment as well as working in the refuge?
I had odd jobs here and there. Once I sold everything in Australia in terms to cars and whatever I had here, my brother supported me for a short period. My parents supported me for a short period. I worked odd jobs here and there. My uncles work at the snowfield, so I worked there during some snow periods. And I worked as a salesman for a period for selling furniture, wrought iron furniture. And I didn't really get into a full-time job because I just simply did not know the language as thoroughly as probably I would as English. My Spanish is okay. I thought I knew Spanish, but once I arrived there, my Spanish was not an understanding to them, I suppose. In terms to writing, I have very little knowledge of writing in Spanish. So,
mm-hmm. So what attracted you to volunteer in the men's refuge? Why did that happen?
The Christian organisation over there is very strong, I suppose. It's similar to, as a campaign, if you look at charitable service in Australia, the first thing you think of is the Salvation Army or the Mission Australia. Salvation Army, because they're always there and campaigning and so forth. In Chile, you don't see homelessness what you do here in Australia. It's quite visible, more so in Australia than what it is overseas. And I think it's because overseas you don't get the pension. I mean, you did get the pension. Sorry, you don't get Centrelink payments. There's no free medical services, no free education, none of this sort of stuff. You have to pay or you have to register, I suppose, if you want to go to higher education and so forth. So if you lose your job, you have to get a move on and do something quickly. In terms to charitable services, there is probably no funding from government. So there's a lot of huge campaigns to do fundraising. And I got there during the period when they were doing that fundraising campaign for the whole organisation. And
what was that organisation called?
Padre Octal. I'll need to translate. Father of Father Chris Riley. Similar to, but imagine that Father Chris Riley existed 50 or 60 years ago, and so that his legacy continues, and that's what happened over there.
Okay, and so it was basically a Catholic charitable organisation.
Exactly.
And they, one of the things they did was look after refuges.
They looked after all family units in terms to children, women and children, families, hospitals, and men's services, youth services. They did everything in terms to what it means to cater for those who are in need. So it was a very, very large organisation.
I think that also the difference you're making, you're drawing a distinction between homelessness there and homelessness here, saying that one of the reasons that homelessness might be visible on Sydney streets is because people actually do have financial support of one kind or another,
yeah.
Centrelink payments in one sense or another, so they can actually survive if they're homeless on the streets, you know, not without difficulty, but you can actually live and still perhaps buy food and the means of survival and so on. But you're saying that in Chile that was impossible. Physically, people wouldn't be lying around the streets or sleeping on the streets in the way that they do here?
Unless you're working in a refuge or you're working in the sector, I suppose, with homelessness, you'd be very vague in terms of what exactly is homelessness. I had no idea that we had homelessness in Australia prior to working here. It wasn't until I started working in City of Sydney that I started noticing homelessness. It's sort of like when you buy, say, a car. When say I buy a brand of a Mazda, you physically did not notice that car prior to actually having that car. So once you get your car, say, oh, look at all these Mazdas that are going around.
Mm.
So you actually take that knowledge onto you once you have that inside of you. When I worked in the refuge overseas, it's a different system altogether. The safety net is basically not really there as much as what it is here in Australia. Safety net meaning, you know, Medicare and hospitals and all that sort of stuff, healthcare. Over there is more of a need that if you don't have it, then you need to try and get it. And if you don't have a house, whether or not it was invisible, because the nightlife in South America is very much different to what cities in Australia. In Australia, say, come 7 o'clock, everyone's indoors in their home and watching the news and whatever. Whilst in South America, the nightlife virtually continues to probably 2 or 3 in the morning. So there is there's a high visible aspect of people on the streets after hours than what... There's less people in the morning. They're all having their siestas. But I did notice there is there's a stronger afterlife after hours in South America than what is here.
So you're saying that homeless people might just blend in with that?
It may have been the fact that they blended in.
Oh, yeah. I see, okay.
Yeah.
So the refuge, I think you were saying about as far as sponsoring a child when you're in Australia... I think what you meant by that you always had an interest in helping people, is that correct?
I've always had an interest in helping people, yes.
And so there was a big campaign on in Chile, a fundraising campaign for this organisation, and you were attracted to it?
I was attracted to it in terms to that was an aspect of, because it really moves the population, that campaign. It's a really big fundraising. It's on the TV 24/7 for that period. My auntie at the time had a newspaper store in say Central Station of Santiago. She was very much linked to this organisation as well. Very much a poor family, but you know, had a tin and had a fundraising campaign going out for people who were in a probably lower grade than what she was. And she, at that stage, I was helping out every now and then with her newspaper store. And then, you know, I think it was just from one conversation to the next, and, you know, how do I get into volunteering and so forth. I had a girlfriend at the time. She was working basically full time. I was doing nothing, right? And I really needed to get on and get involved in something, and I approached them and asked, what do I do? And the next thing, I ended up working for the men's refuge. Mm. After they actually took me to various services, to the children's services, to the hospital, but I ended up choosing the men's refuge.
And so, what did you do there?
My primary role there was not so much digging into case management, because they had the dedicated workers there. I did assist in a lot of paperwork, I suppose, and having an understanding what was happening, my main role was in the kitchen and in the bathrooms, and handing out after hours, once you clean up the dining room and so forth and sweep the floors, you go out towards their quarters and make sure, you know, they have their blankets and so forth, and start, you know, go to bed, turn off the lights, you know, go back to your room, and so sort of, you know, I think you spend half an hour just to get them to go to sleep for the next day. And so you ended up staying there probably a good hour after everything's been shut. I mean, the lights are turned off, and I used to go home and walk home from, I think it was about 11 o'clock at night. Used to be about a good 20 minutes walk to the refuge back to the main road. So back, say 20 minutes, say, from Darling Harbour back to George Street, for an example. So, and then from George Street just to catch a train, the metro over there, back home, then a bus back home, and probably just to get home about 12 o'clock at night, so.
And you must have enjoyed it, because you did it for some years.
I did, a bit over 2 years, 3 days a week. Sometimes I did four. It was on a voluntary basis. Excuse me, but I it was different. It was something that I needed to be there. I wanted to help. I was very much involved in people's lives. You had your ups and you had your downs. I was, for the first time in my life in that refuge, threatened by another resident with a knife. And the words were, you know, what the F are you going to do about it? But, you know, the person was mentally unwell. And the fact that I had sat on his area, on his seat, supposedly, and I had no knowledge of that at the time, I suppose I was still new to finding my ways around and my surroundings and so forth. But, you know, you go through those things and you meet so many different people, so many characters, so many stories. It was very interesting.
Mm. So you came back to Australia, and I think you started looking for work when you got back here, did you?
Yes. When I came back to Australia, after spending 6 years, I was married overseas, and my wife at the time did not want to come back to Australia. She had no intentions to come to Australia. We didn't get married to come to Australia, so it was sort of like, we did spend 2 years in Chile trying for me to sort myself out in terms to get a job and try and stabilise. But I, in my mind, I knew that I really didn't have a future in Chile in terms to, you know, raising a family and supporting my family, buying a house. The possibility was there. It was not a problem. But I knew the difference was such a big difference between what I could have in Australia and what I could have in Chile in terms to wealth and health and education, all that sort of stuff. When we did decide to come to Australia, there was a few challenges, of course. We arrived at my sister's house. She was saving at the time to buy a home, and so she had a very small unit, and she had a small family of her own, and they were very excited to get there. It was sort of like, we were entering someone else's home, different set of rules, 9 o'clock, the lights were out, and we were like, what's going, like, I was in fact not used to the fact that 9 o'clock people were getting ready to go to work the next day, and I was sort of like, how can we not stay up to talk, and, you know, who else is going to come over? I got used to the South American system, whereas I was telling people at night, at 12 o'clock at night, go home, that you have to work the next day. It's sort of like, and when I got to Australia, it was like, okay, this is what I was doing 6 years ago in reality.
Mm.
You know.
So you had to find a place of your own, I suppose.
We were very desperate in terms, there was some tensions, I suppose. Obviously, you know, you're entering someone's house and their rules and so forth and food and all that sort of stuff. I had no money. Everything that I did have was gone. I virtually came to Australia with nothing, absolutely nothing, except with a container that we shipped over with all our wedding stuff and stuff that we collected from overseas. And that was yet to still arrive in Australia for another couple of months later. But
we
arrived with our suitcase, and we had to find... We stayed with my sister for a good number of weeks. My priority at that stage is I had to get a job ASAP. During the time that I was applying for a job, I was applying for Centrelink, and I found this job, probably I think it was about 2.5-3 weeks after I had arrived. It was a job through the local, I'm sure it was local newspaper, in which I went for an interview with Marrickville, and they said, yeah, it's for homeless people. I actually looked at that area in terms to helping, so I was looking at healthcare services, you know, retirement villages and all that sort of stuff where I can provide my support to those in need. And so when they came across this help, Homeless Persons Information Centre, I phoned them and got the job interview, and I came here the following day. So.
And so what were you doing here on your first few days?
The first day was very interesting. The first day was the then senior or then team leader. It was her last day at work that day. So it was kind of interesting. It was only... I came here to the city, it was in level 13. I got introduced to the team and so forth. So I got asked to come in around 11. And we got introduced, and I got explained how the Homeless Persons Information Centre works and so forth. 11:30, I got a crash course on the database then. Got a crash course of the phone system. I got a crash course on how to answer a call. At 12 o'clock, the entire office leaves, and I got left on my own. This is the first day. My boss then, Steve, said, Morris, Susie and the rest of the team are going out to lunch because it's Susie's last day, and you're here to man the fort. So any problems, you give me a call, I'm sure you'll be right. I'm sure you'll be right. And they just all left. And I'm there sitting in the office thinking, oh my God. And the first thing that I do is lock myself out of the phone. And I'm spending about 10 minutes to put this phone back on. And reluctantly, I call Steve. And he goes, what's up, Morris? It was very straightforward. And he goes, oh yes, he didn't say what's up. He goes, I said, hi Steve, this is Morris. And he goes, Morris who? Morris from Homeless Persons, you left me up here, I said. Oh yes, he says, what's wrong? And I said to him that I can't answer the phones because I don't know how to use the phone. And he went through it, and I can hear in the background some of the girls were laughing. And that was quite interesting because Susie, the team leader back then, actually works here now, and she's come back after having, you know, a couple of kids and so forth. And from time to time, we always joke about her half an hour crash course training that she gave me. So and from there, you know, I was given odd jobs, part time jobs here and there, 2 shifts a week, 3 shifts a week. I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks after that, I approached then the team leader and I said that I was informing her that I was going to leave because I really, really need to get a full-time job. And at that stage, I was desperate just to get anything in terms to full-time because there was tensions at home. I wanted to move out. I need to get... I could not leave for $200 or $300 I was getting a week. And I really need to get a full-time job. And that's when I was informed, no, hold on, there's two positions actually going to come up. There's a part-time position, a full-time position. We really would like for you to apply. I must have given a very good impression. I did everything they asked for of me. I'm pretty cluey in terms to if they ask me to do something, I can follow through fairly quickly. So I think I'm a pretty good quick trainer in terms of if I move into another area. They said, Steve likes how you work and so forth, can really much like you to apply. Following week came up, and the interview was, back then, part of the City Council interview was, Morris, do you want the full-time job? And I said, yep, you've got it. And that was my interview.
Wouldn't happen today.
No, it would not happen today. That was basically my interview. I did, and I was there going, I need to restaurant my head, I need to do this, I need to do that. And basically, the next thing, I got a letter offer. I got the full-time position, and I was extremely happy.
So you worked, was that physically here in Town Hall House then?
Yeah.
On a different floor, or where on level 5? On a different floor,
level 13.
Oh. But so it's always been in here, as long it's as you've been working for it?
Yes.
And so you worked basically manning the phones then. Was that your main job?
Back then, yes. My job was the referral officer. So that primary role was responding to calls. And slowly I started to get involved in different projects and both another colleague and myself trained up and to do... to learn the back end of the database in terms to reporting, because when you have a database that needs to report off on a MS-DOS software, so we used to do reports by coding everything, so everything was on a code. And so I slowly learned that, and only two staff then knew how to do all the reports, and I was one of them. So I got involved in a lot of, like, if anything was available, I said, I'll do that, and I'll do that. I like to keep active in terms to projects. The day goes a lot quicker. You don't get, you don't get put in there and just do one job. If you've got multiple tasks, and it makes the work a lot more interesting.
And what was the database about then, when you say you learned more about it? What was the point of the database?
The database, we recorded people's characteristics, reasons for homelessness. Unlike today, you just put a field, put a date, and everything just prints out automatically. Back then, there was... I still have it next door. It's about 2.5 pages of codes that you had to put in just to put one outcome. And so it was very complex. It was very...
Very
time-consuming. Everything had to be manually entered. We had piles and piles and piles of paperwork that had to be entered. We had a data entry person just to enter all these codes in. And so it was not user-friendly, that database.
So I guess when you say now it's much easier to use the database, have other things changed in that way, like technologically, about the job of referring and so on within HBIC?
Yes. We have a database which I helped also introduce in terms to creating better fields and so forth. The database, without the database today, staff have difficulties in terms to referring. The database is very much the heart of the operations of the centre. We rely extremely on the database in terms to clients' current knowledge, past knowledge and characteristics and threats and all that sort of stuff. as we're listening to the client's concerns, we enter those details, and we'll, within, you know, first 5 minutes of conversation, an operator should already establish an outcome. And that's just purely off the information that we register and so forth.
So when you say establish an outcome, by that you mean, I think, that the operator who's taking the call, somebody phones and says, I need a bed for the night, I've got nowhere to stay. They can call up any history on that person, if there's a history of them with HP.
Exactly.
But also they can work out, I think what you're saying is that the most appropriate place for them to be referred to.
We used to, previously, we go back a number of years ago, so prior to 2000, if we would place someone in unsupervised accommodation, say in a hotel or motel, the assumption of that referral would be purely based on what we were told during that conversation. Whereas now, we can listen to the client's details. But on the database, there could be a warning saying, please note the client is extremely suicidal. It may not present today, but has been presenting this way last week or the week prior. So you'll make that assumption whether the client is he's not suicidal or they are suicidal, are they getting treatment? And you may not refer to a hotel under those provisions because of the duty of care there. We had no knowledge back then in those characteristics, but now we can refer, knowing that we've made the correct referral.
So that might also involve, say, somebody who has a history of violence, for instance.
Yeah.
Very important thing to know if you're trying to find them a bed for the night.
Yeah.
What circumstances they might have been in the past.
The relationship between HP and the service has improved immensely. In terms that they also rely a lot on HP in terms to the clients and the history of violence, as you said. There are a lot of clients who are banned from service for various reasons, and anyone can walk in HP today and enter a client's details, and if the client is known to be a violent person, details will be flagged on the file to be cautious in what service you refer, or services already being marked as a non-referable source. It will still be part of our work to still refer the client or offer the client another option. The issues that have happened between the client and the service is between the client and the service. Our role is still to try and find a referral for this person.
It doesn't absolve you of your responsibilities.
No, exactly.
No,
but the
referrals have to be appropriate.
Exactly. But the database today flags that for us, whereas we had no knowledge of this on the old system.
In what circumstances might you refuse to refer somebody? There must be times occasionally with some clients where...
there are probably a very small handful of people that we cannot assist, and those occasions are outside our provisions, where the client is absolutely barred from every single service in the network, and that's probably Metropolitan Sydney. So the client has exhausted or has potentially barred himself out from all services, where in those occasions I do recall one incident where I had to tell a client, you really need to look at going outside Sydney, probably going interstate. Most of these issues, unless you address them personally with the managers of these services, we have absolutely nowhere to offer you. In that case, the client was also barred from all the free church services.
So why was that?
There was unacceptable sexual advancements that he was doing towards female workers. And so there was a number of incidents, and there was a violent incident as well. And he was barred from a particular service for 5 years. And so he was deemed a very high risk for other services where there was a high volume of female volunteers. And so once, when he was barred from all the free services, then there was nothing else that we can offer. He had also, he had no provisions for emergency accommodation through Department of Housing. So the next thing that we offered him was that he needs to consider going to Melbourne or Queensland, where there's a high volume of shelters in those areas. There are other occasions where clients, we will ban them, where these clients, there is a client that we have a set of rules. All his calls are filtered to me. I'm the one in HP that responds to all the abusive calls. So anyone who are not able to respond to abusive calls then gets all those calls, gets transferred to me. In this case, the client was marked as a high aggressive person. So his file has been flagged. We are not to respond to his calls after 6 p.m. He is to call between certain times. Client will be asked only once what we are going to offer. Client will be offered only once to take those options. If not, he would have to call back. But we will no longer continue his abusive and aggression. Mm. When we're talking about abusive and aggression, it's not so much the yelling and the anguish. Is he comes across as vulgarly aggressive, saying, you know, he puts yourself and your family in the picture of what he intends to do to them.
Mm.
And so in those occasions, we still did not mark them as that we are not deemed to help them. We put set of rules. And if those rules are not met, then we will simply not respond to those calls.
And why is it that you're the person who takes the abusive calls? Is it because you're coordinator, or is it because of your personality?
It's not a rule in there. I think I've just placed that rule on my own behalf. We've got all up, I think, at about 14 female staff. We do have a young group of people in there as well. And there are people who appear to be quite sort of strong-headed in terms, but they sort of cause really get to a lot of people, and I've just learned just to take them on board and just be very strong-willed, I suppose, and said, mate, I'm hearing what you're saying, I'm not going to tolerate it, these are my rules, you take it or you leave it. These are lines for you to complain if you don't like my set of rules, but I am not here and nor would I allow for you to abuse my staff in this. And that's the way it always goes in there.
Mm.
I just simply do not tolerate that.
Mm. So obviously you learn in some ways to distance yourself from people who are, I guess you could describe as destructive. You deal with them in a very objective way. But there are also a lot of cases, I think, where the emotional side of things becomes very, it has a big effect on all of you working here. I wondered if you'd mind just telling me a bit about that, what kinds of things people might find very upsetting.
Things that become quite upsetting is child abuse, sexual abuse, extreme physical violence, the mothers who call crying, who generally call crying, who are generally wanting assistance for their kids but cannot have the kids at home. And
why can't they have the kids at home? A violent father, or?
No, I think there are a lot of cases where you hear the mothers, we have done absolutely everything for my daughter, for my son. We cannot continue. We cannot continue. You know, and...
Oh, I see. You mean if the child might be behaving...
He's got behavioural issues, mm. or he's got substance issues and so forth, and the families have just had enough.
Mm.
But it's... The fathers are okay. A lot of times the fathers, mate, just try and get him accommodation. I'll pay whatever needs to be paid, but, you know, my wife just cannot take this no more. But when you hear the mothers, it's the mothers who feel that pain. It's nature of life, I think. You know, it's the mothers who always be beside their children. But it's very heartening hearing a mother telling you that she cannot have her child at home. But though she wants it at home, she needs to have that assurity where we're going to place it and will it be safe and, you know, and can I call tomorrow. That is very sad. Intense when you hear that emotion from the mother. The other emotions are, you know, as I said, child protection issues, or when you're doing a DOCS notification, the removal of children, even though we physically can't do it, we start the process in house.
You started here because you're aware that the children may be being abused in some way or neglected.
The children's neglected. We are mandatory reporters. All homeless staff or HBIC staff are all mandatory reporters. So we have a clear duty of care that if we come across information where it's deemed that the child is at risk, then it's our duty to make a notification. We make notifications every single day. But it's those notifications that you're pushing for immediate action for DOCS to remove these children. Sometimes it can come quite stressful, especially when there's a lot of staff in there who are young mums. I've got a very young crew in there in terms to mothers and so forth.
So that might be drawn to your attention that a situation requires an immediate notification to DOCS, that's the Department of Community Services. How would that be drawn to your attention? You're a referral service that people can ring if they're homeless, or, as you're saying, parents might ring looking for accommodation for a child that basically they're having to kick out of home because the behaviour is intolerable. How would it come to your attention that there's extreme neglect or abuse in a family? I mean, if somebody just rings up here and says, well, we're a family and we need somewhere to sleep tonight, how does it work that you know that their situation is a very extreme one and one where the children are very vulnerable?
Yep. When it comes to young families, I suppose, if we look at a scenario of a young family, and they've known, once we've completed characteristics of a client, there are key questions that you'll be asking. One, obviously, how old the child is. So the children are under 5 years old. In most cases, there are requirements for formulas or for milk or for nappies. When a parent is unknown to be substance abusers, as an example, or when one of those parents are chronic gamblers, and you evaluate their income as a key assessment. So you ask them, how much money do you have and when is your next payment? And so if both parents are not due to get paid for another, say, 7 or 8 days, and in the commencement of your conversation, they're clearly stating, we're hungry, we've got no food, we're homeless, we've been sleeping in the car, you use that reference that after, once you start asking all those questions in terms to, do you have nappies for the child, yes or no? Do I need to get you nappies? You offer those assists in terms to see at what level the client is at. So if you're coming across to the client by saying, do we need to organise some nappies? Yeah, we've only got two. And if I would have come across, or do you have nappies? It could become across like I could become intimidating, or I'm investigating, and they may respond, yes, we do. But if I would say, do you need me to organise some nappies for you? I'm coming across as a more friendly gesture. But this is part of my role in to assess not the needs of the parents in this case no more, but the needs of that child. My role now is no longer mum and dad, it's really this child.
So that by doing it in that friendly way, I think you're saying that you elicit a whole lot of information about
from
the situation of the child.
And so, and even simple things, did you manage to get some formula? What sort of formula are you getting? Do we have enough nappies and so forth? And I said, how come the baby's crying? You know, is it teething? Is it this or whatever? So you ask all those questions that you may not really ask in a normal referral. So you assess the situation more so when you the parents come across as if they're under the influence of a substance. And so from that evaluation, you start asking key questions. Exactly, you know, if I need to get to this, and if I need to get to this for you ASAP, because I can call local service, exactly where you're located. So you start asking key questions in between. And once you evaluate all that information, you make a judgment assessment. Is this child at risk?
Now, when you mention the nappies and the formula and so on for a child, it just leads me into talking a bit more about what HPIC does, apart from, I mean, because HPIC is a telephone service, it could give the idea that basically you just say that it's a very simple procedure, that somebody rings up and says, I'm homeless, I need a bed for the night, and you say, oh, well, Sydney City Mission's got one, or something like that. But there's a lot more to it than that, isn't it? Because apart from the fact of actually locating the services where there might be a bed, or locating the agencies who may be able to assist, you also organise a whole lot of other things as well.
That's exactly right. That a call can generate two outgoing calls from us. We don't just refer a client to the next available service. There's a whole series of questions that we have to ask, and a whole series of information that we can offer. We go from everything from providing from counselling service to financial support to where's the next rehab, you know, where's it, you know, where could I get my methadone, what clinic is available, you know, where I can get some food and storage and all. So there is over 2,500 services linked to our database in terms to provide assistance only, and on top of that there's about, you know, 1,400 services that we can tap into accommodation. So we provide a whole resource of information in terms to ensure the client has, because not everything is about a crisis outcome. In a lot of cases we also prevent homelessness.
So that's quite a significant part of your work, isn't it? Actively preventing homelessness.
Yes.
So can you tell me a bit about that?
Preventing homelessness, if a person is identified, if is phoned up inquiring that they may become homeless in a week or two, we will do the full assessment and we'll see what other services that person may not be aware of that they can tap into, in terms to trying to ascertain that they remain where they are. If a person is simply behind in rent 3 or 4 weeks, a lot of people out there do not realise you can get assistance, financial assistance of that, not necessarily through Centrelink, because you can get a loan from Centrelink up to $500. But you can also tap into other resources, which the City of Sydney does have through its brokerage program, whereas we can pay for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks in back rent, as long as the real estate gives us assurance that that person will continue staying. You know, people who have arrived in Sydney from interstate trying to find themselves a better life in Australia, in Sydney, not realise the rental is way more expensive than what it was in Perth. We'll prevent that by saying, do you have a place you can go back to in Perth? Yes, who is it? And we will physically call Perth, speak to the mother and say, can your son go back if we buy an return ticket? The person will be then informed, you really need to look at your basis of your financial status. Next time you think about it, bring more money, look at the internet, see if you can book something ahead. More than happy to pay for your ticket, and then we'll refer them to the brokerage program, and then they're off the next flight back home.
So you have money that you can spend in a discretionary way to assist people to avoid homelessness.
To avoid homelessness. We do a lot of fares, we do a lot of storage, we do a lot of back rents. We also pay for a lot of rehabs and detoxes. So that's prevention in terms to someone is actively acknowledged that they want assistance. They've gone into a detox program, but they don't have the funds to go into rehab. Now, that is a crucial part to provide assistance, because the person doesn't go into rehab, all that happens that may end up being on the streets and then quickly get back on the gear. So if the service costs $280 or $400, we're more than happy to pay for that, and the person continues on doing another 3 or 6 months program, and hopefully that during that period they will get themselves actively ready to go back into the community as they, you know, off any substance. So we do a lot of rehabs and detox. We also provide a lot of hotel and motel accommodation in terms to people who generally just arrive and have absolutely no idea. Or people, you know, we have a lot of cases where people lose their wallets, more so in Central Station. A lot of bags go missing, a lot of wallets. We've assisted tourists who've seen the situation. We get calls from the Department of Foreign Affairs. We get calls from all walks of life to try and provide assistance, because someone has just, for that moment and in their time in life, they've become homeless because their financial status has been halted, in terms to they've lost their wallet, they're not going to get a key card until Monday, it's a Friday, everything is closed. So we provide that immediate prevention there.
Mm. Now, you've also told me about lots of other things that you do here. I think you told me that, I think fairly recently, PageBig itself decided to put together a whole lot of toiletries bags. What was that all about?
Toiletry bags. We initiated a few years ago to do winter appeals, whereas along with the social club,
that's the social club here at the City
social
of
club
Sydney.
The City of Sydney. They helped us organise the winter appeal, where we did collections. People were asked to bring in blankets, and we also did donations through the social club. And at one stage, I think we collected $980. The City of Sydney Credit Union donated $500 towards our course. With that money, we decided to buy, I think it was 50 phone cards, and we went out shopping. We went to the to Coles and $2 shops and all that sort of stuff, and we created a toiletry bag, where it consisted of two brushes, a comb, a handkerchief, a napkin, a $5 card, a pen, a small pad, the HB card, something that then was then given to the City of Sydney outreach team, which they in turn distributed to all the rough sleepers that are sleeping on the streets. It was something that we want to give back, I suppose. It was just an initiative that we introduced in-house. Then 2 years after that, we did another blanket appeal, where all over, you know, a couple of hundred of blankets got donated to us, and they will then in turn give it all to Mission B in the outreach team to distribute out.
Hmm.
So,
So there you're looking at people who are long-term chronic homeless, probably.
Long-term chronic homeless.
Assisting them,
yes.
Who are not really your main client base, are they? Your main client base is people who are seeking not to be homeless.
Exactly. Or currently still active in terms of society. A lot of chronic homelessness people have probably backed away from that sort of linkage, hence why the street outreach is trying to reintegrate that offer of assistance. We once again look at another project at the end of the year. There's a few ideas being flagged currently in-house, to whereas we're going to be looking at providing a barbecue at one of the parks. So it'll be a community park barbecue for the homeless. We're also looking at with the Harbour Foreshore to do this cinema out, to provide one of those nights for the homeless people.
Oh, these are the outdoor cinemas.
Outdoor cinemas.
That happen in the summer.
Yeah.
Hmm.
The other one was to provide a band in the park, as well as some music activities, and then probably more like link up, Centrelink, the Department of Housing, and other community services that can provide an information day for people who are sleeping rough on the streets. These are all ideas that are being currently flagged as part of the 25th anniversary that we'll be most likely promoting once we get some budget figures and so forth, where we can do it, say we're going to provide an event at the end of the year. So so we're already looking at what else we can do in terms to project work to offer back, because it's I think it's nice for us to contribute back as well, because it's not just about referral and
I guess it puts a more personal face on it.
It puts more of a personal face on it, yeah. And because homeless people are not the degrading people that many people still see them as. They're people. They're no different than you and I. You know, they're people with feelings, and you know, they've got children, and they've got a history, and they've got their grandma and their granddad. You know, they've a lot of people have been in. If you would have asked them 5 or 6 or 2 years or 3 years ago, if they would ever contemplate they would become homeless, they would say absolutely not.
Now, I think the figures are really increasing, the figures of homelessness, or at least the number of inquiries coming through HVIC has really increased recently. Is that correct?
We have increased. We increased from 1 year to the next close to 10,000 calls.
What's that on a percentage?
So we went from, say, 50,000 calls to 60,000 calls. We're probably looking at the 09 calendar year finishing off at close to 70,000 calls. There was a huge increase in demand for assistance during the peak periods when the interest rates went up, and we went through this global financial crisis. I don't think no services or no one expected a harsh reality was there, but the housing. The lack of affordable housing was very intimate. A mother with two kids earning $690 a fortnight just simply cannot afford to pay rent at $300 a week. And I'm talking about the great outer west of Sydney paying $300 minimum a week. So it's just simply not affordable. So those who were in housing or have sustained their housing tenancy for quite some years, we're being pressured to pay higher rents. And so, hence why we started seeing a lot of people fall back in their repayments, because they rent from $240 a week to $360. And so, and you had a lot of mortgage defaults, either through the landlord or the proprietor, or secondary mortgages, people who had, they had other houses which then they leased.
Investment
properties, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so people would phone us that we got an eviction notice from the bank. We were paying her rent. The landlord appears the landlord hasn't been paying for a number of weeks or months. And so
they actually get evicted not because they haven't paid, but exactly, because the landlord hasn't paid.
Because
I think you said that happened in boarding houses too.
In a lot of boarding houses, we started seeing the shift in boarding houses prior to the financial crisis. I think it was a year prior to that, whereas there was a lot of investment properties going up. We also identified at one stage all seaside areas from all the way down to Cronulla, all the way up to Manly, a shift in people last permanent accommodation coming from these areas. We'd never seen it historically. And then we started seeing that a lot of those people were in rooming houses and boarding houses, were asked to move. When you're looking at a few years ago in Bondi, you can go to a rooming house for $150 a week, are now costing $300 to $400 a week. We started seeing that sort of shift. People started to renovate and just inflated their rentals, and which are still continuing today.
Mm.
But there was a huge increase back then as well.
Mm. Now, that relates to, I guess, the housing stress being, recently a much bigger proportion of causing people to be homeless, as opposed to things like social problems, mental health issues, alcoholism, and whatever. But you've also talked about on another occasion about how some people actively choose to be homeless. I guess they are not the people who are ringing HPIC. They're another group. Would you mind just talking to me about that a bit, just how you see that?
I don't think no one chooses to become homeless. There is that element in the community from a lot of other people who openly say that they choose to become homeless. There are still people in society who preventions are in place for them, but still actively need that continued support because they're still in the same corner or they're still doing the same rounds and they still appear to be homeless. But if when you further investigate, they're not really homeless. They've been housed, they've been supported, they've been given a package, and those at times is the difference where people appear to see them as choosing to become homeless. You know, I suppose it's
You're saying that they have been given support to be in public housing and so on, but for some reason
they're still actively on the streets.
Yeah,
but in many occasions, a lot of these people do suffer from chronic mental health issues. That's been part of their lifestyle for many, many years. I have my own different opinion on people who are out there with a banner saying I'm homeless or with their cardboard, help me out, I need to pay for my accommodation tonight. Those are the people who distort people's perception of what is truly homeless. Those are the people who are choosing to be out there, claiming to be homeless, claiming that need assistance, claiming they need to pay for the bed. And I have absolutely, this is my opinion, I have no time for those people because we have offered, and I think they provide the wrong opinion to what is really the true face of homelessness today.
I think you're talking there about, I think it's developed in Sydney over the last few years of people begging on Sydney streets.
Begging
there's quite
Sydney
a few
streets.
People at particular corners where people will sit down with a piece of cardboard in front of them and say, have no money, starving,
exactly,
have no bed for tonight and that kind of thing, and ask you to donate. But I guess what you're saying is that, in fact, if they were actively seeking a bed, they could ring HPIC and they could probably get one.
Exactly. They can ring HPIC probably 99.9% sure that all these people would have been actively offered assistance through the outreach team as well.
Right.
Because they're part of the Sydney LGA. You know, we're talking about a city that has a very low, moderate residential population. Sydney City is
the centre of the city.
Mm. But yet you seem to see a lot of people asking for food through the street food vans, asking for money through the streets. You know, when you look at areas where there is a higher population in unemployment, there is a higher population in housing properties. You don't see in those communities people begging for money. You don't see the long queues in food vans and so forth. And I suppose that is an area that I'm yet still to be convinced of. I'm yet still to be whether the people in the city are truly in need of that financial assistance, because you surely don't see in the areas which are very much so hitting their bottom dollar or their pockets quite aggressively. But yet we don't seem to see that high volume of calls for we need a food van out there, we need... You see beggars on the streets, no, because they're actually tapping into the safety net, which is Centrelink, and food parcels and so forth. But in the city, I'm not sure whether there are that element that people just simply take advantage of that resource, and resource being you and I, who may from time to time go past and throw in a dollar coin in their pouch or whatever.
Now, you also have mentioned to me you often get spontaneous donations from different sectors of the community.
Yes, we've had some interesting donations. Everything from hundreds of beanies and gloves, which they were distributed across Sydney. So if you would have seen a new fashion out there.
So this would also most likely go to people who were chronically homeless? Or
exactly. Mm-hmm. They just went simply to the services and refuges and outreach to distribute out. We had beanies and hats, hundreds of them, which we distributed. We've also had hundreds of underwear given to us as well. We've also had boxes. I think it was at one stage over 20 boxes of bras, ranges from all sizes but the one colour, this one. The what last colour? Patch, the last, it was some light blue or something.
Yeah.
They're all brand new, so they weren't seconds. They were all still with their labels and so forth. Basically, it was the brand did not run with that stock, and so all that extra stock was given to us.
So it'd be the companies or the managers and so on thinking, what can we do with this?
What can we do with this product?
Mm.
Give it to HWIC would then distribute. And so in that last occasion with the bras, we decided to give them all to the Women Domestic Violence Services, which everyone was given an area and a couple of boxes, and everyone drove them to the destination. The other prior to that was underwear, undergarment for females, singlets and underwear and bras. We gave those to just women and children services. So we broke them up into different, last time we hit, now let's give them to the DV services. The beanies and gloves, they just went out to, we just made random calls, do you want beanies, do you want gloves, and so forth. Yeah. You get the odd donations, a $5 Canadian bill, can you bank this for the homeless? It's probably still sitting in my drawer for the past 5 years.
It poses more problems.
It does pose more problems than what it's worth, yeah. But it's nice, you know. So any donations to it, we'll just filter it from here. I think the Marriott group, the hotel chain, donated hundreds of blankets when they changed all the blankets in their hotels. And all of those blankets were distributed out fairly quickly. So,
Now we probably should wind up pretty soon, but I wondered if you could just tell me, if you don't mind, just talk to me about what you like about this job. I'm assuming you do like the job. You've been here for quite a long time and you actively sought this kind of work. So what's good
about it? I love my job. It has a lot of challenges in terms. I've learned a lot in this job to know. I think I've learned. My dad once said to me in Spanish, and it might sound a bit foul, but he goes, "Morris, never spit towards the ceiling, because you never know when that's going to hit you back in the face." My dad took us, the family, to South America when I was 16, I think. I hated it. I hated South America. The first 2 weeks, I want to go back home because, and I think, one, I think I was a 16-year-old kid that knew everything. Secondly, I could not understand why people would live that way. Why is the road not paved? Why... how can we only have one bathroom, one toilet? Why do we have to turn the gas on to put the hot water system on? And it was all these why. Unknowingly, my dad actually installed the hot water before we got there, so paid for it. They got us a colour TV. Everyone else had black and white TVs. And I just hated it. I just couldn't stand to it. I think it was more so because I was so used to living in Australia.
You
have
quite a high standard of living in Australia.
We
have
the comforts. So this job, I suppose I'll use that as a reference, I suppose, because this job has taught me also, I suppose it's taught me to better myself. I never take things for granted. I love the fact that what I have is great. I'm not a person that is materialistic. So what I do have is I'm happy with. You know, my kid's mother drives around with a brand new car, and I've got a very dump of a car that I drive, and I'm happy with that. I'm really happy with that. That has, I think it's taught me a lot in terms to the reality of life, which I have absolutely no knowledge of. I thought I knew. I thought I was king of the world. Yeah. Mm. But this job focuses on a lot of emotions and a lot of reality. You know, simple things that, you know, you can walk outside this office today, you know, fall in a hole, break your leg, and the next thing, you're out of a job because you don't have no wages insurance or whatever, you lost your income, and then you go for those spiral of maybe potentially becoming homeless. But in terms to my job, I like my job. It's got a lot of challenges. And I like leading as well.
Which you do now as which coordinator.
I coordinate. I've slowly evolved myself from becoming the referral officer to the senior referral officer to a team leader, and acting in various positions as the manager and coordinator to being offered the position 4.5 years ago and to where I sit today. It brings a lot of joy in many occasions when you do offer the impossible, and that is the most wonderful aspect of this job, that you look at a case and you hear their problems and you hear their anguish and you hear their emotions, and you're saying to yourself, I can't do this, and in fact you've actually managed to do the impossible. That is the beauty of it, that you left work and say, I've just managed to find a home for mum and dad and 6 kids. It wasn't available to that, but you've managed it.
Mm.
Because it may have taken you 20, 30 calls. It may have taken a lot of networking in terms, we'll do this, we'll do that, and I'll make sure that gets offered, and to get an outcome. It's a very joyous feeling when you leave here.
So your father meant that expression, don't spit up at the ceiling because it might fall
on your face. Might fall back through on your face.
So what does it...
My dad wanted us to see the reality of life.
Right. So he's saying, don't get too big for your boots, or...
Yeah. My dad came from a poor family,
mm.
and he wanted us to have an understanding of what in reality was meant to be poor.
Mm.
And he intentionally took us to the poor side of the country when we got off the airport.
We
could have gone through the freeway. No, because I heard him say, make sure we go through that community.
Mm.
So he gave us a reality check of what could happen in life so easily. And always, because he always pushed for the fact, look at your education, look what you're doing, you know, be conscious in what you spend, save some money, you know, go out and do what, have fun and do all that sort of stuff, but just be, you know, always bring yourself back to your feet and look where you're walking.
Mm.
It wasn't in reality till 1998, I think it was, when I went to Bali, Indonesia, spent 2 or 3 weeks in Indonesia, and I went through these trips in the inland. And I really saw some poverty there, and I thought I'd exist in Africa, in these third world nations. I'll never live there. We don't live there. Why would it ever happen to me? But you know, I remember coming back that time, and I went to my dad and I patted him back, and I just said, "Dad, I love you. You know, and I thank you so much for what you've given us." You know, it really hit me then. And when I went back to Chile for the second time, I had a different view. I didn't care that my uncle heated coal outside and that was his heater. I went out there and said, you want some more coal? You know, are you going to bring the heater in soon? Whereas before I had that, it's going to be no coal. Man. So I had that different perception. Mm. Many people still look at that differently. I remember when I really first started here, a colleague of mine said, how much do you get a week? And I'm talking about like 10 years ago or something. I said, oh, I end up getting about $500 a week. She said to me, I've got a cousin, he's newly married and they're really poor. And I said, why? He goes, well, and she didn't know at that stage, and she goes, oh, well, he only gets about $500 a week and he's struggling. And I was thinking, I said, oh shit, no, that's how much I get. I'm not poor. You know, I've learned to live with my income.
It's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, she had a different way of life, you know. She didn't think twice whether going out there and spending $50 today was, that's fine, $50, okay. You know, we're collecting for money. How much do you need, 50, 60? And I was thinking, oh, you know, could I spare $10 out of my wallet? Yeah. I was willing to give, but I was also being conscious of what I need to have for the following pain.
Mm.
So, and I suppose this job has learned me a lot into family, you know, respecting yourself, most importantly, respecting your family, you know, respecting your children, and respecting life in general, because all of these areas we tap in every single day, whether the person is homeless because they had a fallout with the missus, the wife, the family, the uncle, whatever, you know, had a fallout with the neighbours, and you know, was doing or was just being a complete idiot, and or had mental health issues, and you know, they were going through some phase in their life, they were being sexually active. It does teach you a lot about life, this job. So you have a very clear reality check of what actually is happening out there.
Well, that's terrific, Morris. Thank you very much for that.